Okay, still another hour to go with Mac Maloney as we talk about his work beyond Area 51 and your phone calls. Lots more to talk about when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Agents or people involved in espionage are called spooks. And you had a friend, Mac, named Spook.
Well, that's true. I hope he's still my friend. Yep, he helped me put this book together. We've known each other for years, and he's led an interesting life, spent a lot of time in Army intelligence, and then went to work for a company that in turn works for the three-letter agencies, intelligence agencies. And
NSA, CIA.
Yes, and the FBI. And, you know, he's someone who has an interest in UFOs, but it's interesting when you can tell when you talk to him about it. And it's that old story, you know, have you ever heard of anything of UFOs? I would ask him officially, and he'd say no. And I'd say, if you did, could you tell me? And he'd say no. So he's kind of, you know, always kind of painted into a corner when it comes to this subject. But he did provide us with a lot of information, putting the book together on locations of these secret bases, what may or may not go on there. Just interesting to have someone like that, as I said before, kind of looking over my shoulder while I was putting the book together.
And you're sure he wasn't trying to mislead you?
Well, I'm not sure, to tell you the truth.
Really?
Okay. I'm not sure. He certainly gave us information on locations and put us in touch with people who were, for instance, at Tonopah or who were at AUTEC, the Navy's Area 51. But I don't think I don't know. I have to answer that truthfully. I don't know whether he was trying to mislead us or not. I don't think so, but I really don't know.
Because, you know, we've talked about misinformation, and they seem to be into that these days.
Well, that's what they're all about these days, is misinformation, disinformation. I do know that other people that I worked with on the first book at the same place where he worked at, people helped me with the, in the same way, kind of editing and making sure I had back straight after reading the entire book. This is UFOs in Wartime. They try to convince me that all these UFOs people were seeing over ICBM bases in the 60s and 70s were really the SS-71 Blackbird. And I know that's not a fact. I think they try to have me go down another path with that. But you just don't know. That's their business. And they're very good at the business. So it's an interesting question. I have no idea whether they were trying to mislead me or not. I hope not, but I don't know.
Mac, I spent 9 years with the Navy, and I'm pretty sure they've got a special area for submarines down in the Caribbean somewhere.
Right. That's AUTEC.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. What was interesting about that place, and it's an acronym that stands for Atlantic Undersea Test and Evaluation Center. And what they do down there, what we know they do down there, is it's very close to an ocean trench that goes down more than a mile. So they bring their new nuclear submarines there and put them through trials. And also new captains of submarines will go there and
train.
But what's interesting about the place, well, there's a number of things interesting about it. First of all, there's billions of dollars worth of sensoring equipment there, both underwater and radar. They can see anything coming towards that place for hundreds of miles around in the air and also under the water. But what's interesting is that many UFOs are spotted there, many USOs are spotted there, unidentified submerged objects, many stories in the book about people seeing these things under the ocean and coming out of the ocean flying away like a typical UFO. Now, and the Navy denies all this. But so you have to ask the question, well, if you have billions of dollars worth of sensoring equipment down there, you can see anything under the water and in the sky. If you're missing all this stuff, that means that those billions of dollars were misspent because this monitoring equipment isn't working very well, or they're misleading us about it. But the other interesting thing is that this isn't in the United States. It's on Andros Island in the Bahamas, and it's right in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. So I just thought it was very interesting that the U.S. Navy decided to build their, maybe what is their biggest, one and only secret base in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle.
It's an amazing story, and Mark is with us in Oakland, California to get things going this hour. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, Mark.
Hey, I just had a couple of comments about what your guest was saying earlier. One about the Dulce. I think there's more truth to that than is being said. Like with Phil Schneider, when he was doing speeches about that, he actually had medical proof that he suffered from a rare mineral. Like a blast when he fought in there, and it wasn't able to be treated by doctors. And along with that, there were other people that corroborated his story. And I think there's a bit more to Dulce than just one person going around and spouting stuff off. Also, the second thing was during World War II, when he was talking about the possibility of people saying that the Germans may have had UFOs and there was nothing to it, that they actually in 1943 and 44, and there was film and photographs of this, they actually were building UFO-style aircraft that were designed to move vertically up and down. And they had successful test flights of them, albeit not high up in the atmosphere to do combat. But they actually did build aircraft that did do that. So they did have some stuff to that. And to try and rewrite history, though, they were pretty evil people. To black out other things and just write about one thing, that's pretty much doing about the same they did as far as, like, burning books. You know, if you rewrite history, you're just doing the same thing and perpetuating evil, you know.
Well, can I answer that, George?
Sure. You sure
can. Well, you know, there's no history to rewrite. If you look into, especially, let's go to the Nazi wonder weapons first. Yes, they did have advanced weaponry. They had the first jet fighter. They had the first ballistic missiles. They had a lot of things of aeronautically that were interesting. But because they had, they were running out of resources so quickly. They were losing the war so quickly, running out of money. Manpower, scientists, you name it, that there was no way that they could bring a number of these things to fruition. Once again, when we went in there after the war and searched Germany high and low for all these wonder weapons, they found nothing along the lines of UFOs or UFO fighters or secret bases in the Antarctica or bases on the moon. You know, this stuff is just frankly nonsense, because we also have to remember that several hundred German scientists came over to the United States, Wannevern Braun being one of them, and a couple hundred of his colleagues, and they're the people who made up the foundation of NASA and who put the United States on the moon. And for us to get to the moon, they had to create this enormous rocket, the Saturn V rocket. It is a liquid fuel. It's fueled. It has nothing to do with anti-gravitational devices, to basically put a thimble into orbit and then have that thimble go to the moon, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So if these people, if Wernher von Braun knew, had any knowledge of anti-gravitational devices, UFOs and things like that, then why would they basically build NASA on this on the premise that you have to build this huge rocket just to put three men up in on the moon? He would have knowledge of all these wonder weapons. He didn't. If he had, he would have passed it on to us. He didn't. Therefore, as I said before, there is no history to rewrite. That stuff just didn't happen. It's all fiction.
If the Germans didn't come here, Project Paperclip, after the war, how far do you think we would have advanced in terms of space without them?
Without them, probably it would have taken us probably twice as long.
The Russians would have beaten us. Then.
The Russians would have beaten us. Now, a lot of German scientists were captured by the Russians, and they went to a place.
They went there, too. That's
right. They went to a place called Kapustin Yar, which we also mentioned in the book. But there weren't as many of them, and I think that the more knowledgeable ones, especially in ballistic missiles, came over to the West. In fact, they were trying, like, you know, the hardest to be captured by the West and not captured by the Russians.
Well, did we not pay them salaries, too?
Oh, sure. Oh, they were very well taken care of. Wernher von Braun was very well taken care of. And a lot of those German scientists, they wound up down in New Mexico for a while and then Huntsville, Alabama. They put us on the moon. I mean, there's the Nazi people who worked for the Nazis put the United States on the moon. But that's a very good question. If they had not come over here, it would have been at least double. I mean, we wouldn't have landed on the moon in 69, maybe 89. in the 90s, and the pitch against the Russians would have beaten us.
Calvin in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Calvin. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Happy to talk to you, man. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to say something about the fear aspect of seeing an alien. Once when I was about 12 years old, I had a thing. I was at home by myself, and I was in a bedroom, and in the window there was a gray. And he had a robe on, and he gave me this come-hither finger, like, come to me. And I was so terrified, I threw the covers over my head.
I don't blame you.
Fetal position. I'm serious. And I was like, I remember just coming back, and I don't remember coming back. I just remember looking back up at the clock, and about 3 or 4 hours had passed by. And it was like, and I remember having a dream not too long after that. And it was a two-dimensional grid, and it was a blue room. It was like we were sitting on blocks, me and another little guy, and the alien was, like, teaching us something. He was holding his finger up, and he was trying to instruct us in something. And it's just a matter of the fear. And as far as your guest saying that the aliens are probably humans from the future, I was told a story once by a guy. He was in an ancient Muslim folklore that said that mankind had developed their technology to the point where they no longer use their bodies as much, and they atrophied. And they came back in time, 30,000 years back in time, for DNA so they could keep the human race going. And that was another thing. I think your guess is spot on that. Yeah. And to digress for just a second, I want to tell you a question you had earlier about why people were choking. When people choke like that, it's because they think they can get the food out themselves. And so they don't want any help because they're always used to all their lives doing it themselves. And I also want you to get a copy of that book that I wrote so that you can read it and we can do something with it. We can get some food banks together.
Well, you got to do that, no doubt. Well, Mac, you know, you're spot on. People believe that. Your research is spot on. Good for you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I really think that I think going back into ancient history is actually a good place to look into UFOs. I mean, there is evidence that something happened on this planet around 12,000 BC. Graham Hitchcock is someone who goes into that a lot.
Hancock, yeah.
Yeah, right, Hancock. Yeah. And there are these fortresses that all around the world. They're in Turkey. They're down in South America that if you really look at them, people want to call them temples, but when you look at them, they look like fortresses. They look like there was some kind of a war here 12,000 BC or 12,000 years ago. If what I'm always advocating is the scientific approach to looking into UFOs, if that comes true someday, I think that's where you start. I don't think you start in 1947 with Kenneth Arnold. I think you start going way back in ancient history and try to interpret what these ancient writings really say, and have in mind that maybe they're talking about UFOs. Maybe the Indian texts are talking about UFOs. Start at that point and then work your way to the present. I think that's the best way to have the scientific approach to trying to figure out what the UFO puzzle is all about.
Okay, let's go to John in New York City. Welcome to the program. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Interesting show there, and boy, those facts are really interesting that you hear about here. In 1956, I was stationed out in San Diego at the air base, and we got a call from some woman called in, and she says, I have all my mental facilities and my faculties, and she says, if you come out here now, my lawn is all on fire. There was a spacecraft on here, and it just took off. I have no idea what happened after that because I never heard. But then back in New York State, I was walking down at 3 o'clock in the morning. I had a bright light stop right over the top of me, and in about 1 second, it was gone. I don't know where it came from. I never knew where it left. So not all spacecrafts are, not everything looks like a spacecraft.
No, that's true, and I would have loved to have seen that scorched earth from that woman. We don't hear too many stories about that anymore, Mac. In the old days, remember we'd hear stories of tripod holes and things like that?
Right. Well, one of the most famous sightings like that happened to Gordon Cooper, who was an astronaut. And before he became an astronaut, he was a test pilot out at Edwards Air Force Base. And in 1957, he had a film crew out on one of the runways taking pictures of airplanes landing there. And a UFO came right over the heads and landed and it was a tripod type assembly. They left a little bit of scorched earth, and they took off as soon as they saw that they were being filmed. And that film was then sent out to the Pentagon. Gordon Cooper himself sent this film to the Pentagon, and he was sure that he was going to be called at some kind of an investigation into this, and he never was. And then he went on to be one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. What's interesting is that he, after he retired from the astronaut corps, he fought to his dying day to have the government release his, you know, whatever they knew about UFOs. And here's a guy who, he's not some crackpot. He's one of our astronauts, one of our heroes. And he couldn't get them to open the vault. So if he couldn't do it, I don't know who can. One of the scorched earth tripod assembly UFOs, two of his men actually filmed it, and that film has never seen the light of day.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, when an astronaut tells you he has seen something very bizarre, you got to believe it.
You have to believe him. You're right.
I think he saw his first one in 1951.
Right. He was stationed in an air base in what was then West Germany, and they saw a lot of UFOs going over this air base for about a week. And they would scramble fighters. Back then, the fighters couldn't go as high as these UFOs were flying. Of course, at the time, people thought that they were Russian in nature. And then that happened in the early 50s, and then he saw had this amazing experience in 1957, tried like crazy to get the government to release that film. It never happened. So as you say, if an astronaut tells you he's seen something, you have to believe it. It's just too bad that the government just didn't go along with him and release everything they knew about this incident.
This is what Cooper had said. He had held claim until his death that the U.S. government is indeed covering up information about UFOs. He gave an example of President Harry Truman, who said on April 4th of 1950, "I can assure you that flying saucers, given that they exist, are not constructed by any power on Earth." He also pointed out that there were hundreds of reports made by his fellow pilots, many coming from military jet pilots sent to respond to radar or visual sightings from the ground. In his memoirs, Cooper wrote that he had seen other unexplained aircraft several times during his career, and also said hundreds of similar reports had been made. And he further claimed these sightings had been swept under the rug by the government. And throughout his later life, Cooper expressed repeatedly in interviews that he had seen UFOs and described his recollections for the documentary Out of the Blue. It's an amazing story, Mac.
It sure is. And once again, you have to believe someone like that would put their career on the line by talking about UFOs and asking the government to release everything they knew about UFOs. But once again, it didn't pan out as far as he was concerned.
Well, and Edgar Mitchell says similar things, though he never saw anything. He's got insiders who have told him about this.
Right, right. And these are the people that we should be listening to. These are the people who should be at the fore talking about UFOs. But, of course, Gordon Cooper can't now, but Edgar Mitchell is still around. And,
yep.
And people like them should come forward and talk about these things. But there's that ridicule factor, and especially if you're in the military, it's not going to do your career any good if you talk about UFOs, and that's just the way it is.
We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take final phone calls as we talk about Beyond Area 51. On our next Coast to Coast program, Reality Begins with Consciousness. Make sure you're part of that show. We're going to come back in a moment with Mac Maloney, and we'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. What's the surprise ending in the book, Mac? Can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about it. The book begins, as I mentioned before, with myself and my spook friend having a couple beers and me telling him about the idea for the book and asking him if he'd kind of check draft of my chapters as we progressed. And so then when the book was done, he had read the whole book, and we made plans to go have a couple more beers, and it wasn't at the place we went to first time. He brought me to a very interesting place in the greater Boston area. We talked a little bit more about what the book was about, and then we walked down the street, and we went into this, I can only describe it as a very famous place. And what he said was, you know, what really happens is, I mean, there are secret bases all around the world. He says, you've uncovered a number of them in your book. So they're not really that hard to find if you really look for them. But he told this story about how he was at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida and saw a building that was heavily guarded, surrounded by barbed wire. And he said to one of the people guiding it, this is when he was in Army Intelligence, he says, is this where they hide the UFOs? And the person said to him, if we were going to hide something like that, we wouldn't hide it here. We'd hide it in plain sight. And he just kind of made a case for that. And as he's telling me this, and we're sitting in this very famous place, he said, this is what they would do. They would hide things in plain sight, and maybe they would hide them in plain sight, maybe in a place just like this. And he kind of indicated the buildings that were all around us. And when I understood at that point what he was talking about, it surprised me. And it really kind of, it's kind of like the perfect punchline to the book is that, yes, there are secret bases out there. They do secret things at them, test weapons and so on and so forth. But if they had something that they really had to keep secret, something having to do with UFOs, ETs, or whatever, they would probably keep it in a place like Megiddo, like we were talking about. Megiddo was a secret base, but it was in plain sight. It was on top of a mountain. Everyone knew where it was. I wish I could reveal to you where we were, because I think it was very interesting, but I think it's just best that people find out for themselves.
Okay, back to the calls we go. John in Bonnie Lake, Washington, west of the Rockies. John, go ahead.
Yes, talking about hidden secret bases, and the word came to me about when the music's over, and it's funny that you just got through playing The Doors. And the topic that I want to address is from First Chronicles, and it's about a place called Barber that was a connection to Jerusalem's Temple of Herod, which was outside in the outer realms where secrets were being held, and that those places are now being held away from our identity, our understandings, and that how that we are, God has laid a plumb line down. This is the last plumb line.
Well, it may be the last plumb line, whatever that may be, Mac.
It could be a ley line. There's a lot of ley lines in England that people think have some kind of supernatural power to them, but who knows?
Let's go to Brian, truck driving in Ohio, first-time caller. Hello, Bri. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Mac. How you guys doing?
Wonderful.
Hi, Brian.
All right. Hey, I wanted to share a story. I'm at Navy. I was talking to one of my truck mechanics, and he was telling me he was Navy, and he was a search and rescue guy, but he was stationed in Antarctica. And he was down there for like 6 years, and he was telling me about a base that the CIA was building at the time in the early 90s down there underground, a huge base. And they were stockpiling all kinds of supplies and different stuff. But I was just curious to see if you knew anything about that, Mac.
Well, I've never heard of a secret CIA base in Antarctica. It would be difficult to do, I think, because just to get, you know, the resources and to get the supplies that you would need to stay down in Antarctica. I mean, there are research stations down there that are cut off for a lot of part of the year. They have to fly an emergency flight sometimes to get people out who are sick or to bring in food and supplies and medicine. So to actually have a base down there with a lot of people living down there and doing who knows what, I think that would be very hard to do logistically. But that said, and knowing what I know about the CIA, I wouldn't put anything past them.
Great. Thank you.
I wouldn't put anything past any of them. Donald in Tulsa, Oklahoma on our Skype line. Donald, go ahead.
Hi. Great show. I've made the drive from Las Vegas to Reno about 50 to 75 times over my lifetime and have seen a lot of the things that you've talked about tonight, including several night passes of the stealth fighter or bomber outside the, Indian Springs area.
Sure.
The most interesting thing to me, though, in that area that you can see while driving that route is Hawthorne, Nevada. Have you ever, you know, investigated that as a in plain sight sort of secret base? You know, they have that sign there that says underwater naval ammunition testing area?
Well, there's a lot of places out in Nevada that that the military does exotic weapons testing. Area 51 is just one of them. Tonopah is another place. Indian Springs that you mentioned is where a lot of drones are actually flown from, drones that are over Afghanistan and Pakistan. Hawthorne, Nevada, there's probably two dozen places out in Nevada where the U.S. military, U.S. government, and the spook agencies are doing things. In fact, the whole idea for the Beyond Area 51 was I had spoken to someone 20 years ago, and I said, is there any Area 52s, Area 53s, and so on, meaning are there other places out in Nevada, especially Nevada and our out west, where they're doing these secret things that we just don't know about? And he said, yes, they're all over the place out there. So probably, maybe, out in Nevada is one of them.
Maybe so. Let's go to Anita, Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hi, Anita.
Hello. I'm 92 years old.
Well, good for you.
I was one of few that are left that saw the firing off of Long Beach. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and my dad and mom woke me up and asked me to step outside, and we stood on our porch and watched all this, the searchlights, and could hear the booming of the shot, the guns.
Okay.
That's interesting.
That is fascinating.
Yes, it is.
Tell me more.
Well, that's all I can say. I never, they didn't say much about it in the next few days, but then the newspapers picked it up, and of course it was all over the newspapers. And another time I was at a movie on in East Los Angeles, and when it came out, the lights were all out. It was just completely dark out. I imagine it was about maybe 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. And we could hear something, but we couldn't tell what it was because, you know, we could hear booming, but we couldn't tell what it was. So everybody just stood around and looked at one another and couldn't figure out what it was. But those are the two incidents that I remember being my age 21.
Did they ever follow up, Anita, with what they thought it was?
No, they did not. That was one time that none of the newspapers picked that up, but there was dozens of people just standing there. Of course, all the cars had stopped, and most of them had their lights out, their headlights out. And if they did have them on, they were half covered. Everybody had to cover the bottom, the top part of their headlights, so that you just had a half of a light, you know, on your headlight.
Were you scared?
No, I was not scared at all. And I'm still that way. Nothing bothers me. My husband was in the Air Force for 21 years, and we traveled all over the world. And at different times, there were skirmishes in the countries that we lived in, Japan and France. And I never was afraid, and I passed that on to my children, too.
Good for you, Anita. But you don't sound like a day over 60, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
I don't feel like it either.
Good for you. You take care. How about that, Mac? 92 years old. We should be so lucky, huh?
I would love to know her secret.
My gosh, that's a show all by itself. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Colorado. David's with us. Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Hi, George. Congratulations on your contract extension into infinity. If there was anybody deserving.
Thank you, Dave.
In any industry, it would be you, sir.
Thank you. Very kind of you.
Mac, are you real familiar with this in Louisville? You've been there a few times, would you say?
Excuse me?
I travel through there a lot. I go been through there 100 times. I go from Crestone. Are you familiar with Crestone?
What state are we talking about?
Colorado,
San Luis Valley.
Oh, no, go ahead. No, I haven't been to the St. Louis Valley. No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I go through there all the time, and there's a great sand dunes national park.
Mm-hmm.
And right along the border of the valley is the Sangre de Cristos, which is the blood of Christ. So I don't know if there's any any connection there, but I thought I'd just throw it in. But anyway, I was driving through from Crestone through the right through the heart of San Luis Valley on my way up to a town called Cuchara, Colorado. I play music up there quite a bit. And I was driving, and I know there's no railroad tracks on the main road that goes through there. And I was driving, and like looked like 5 miles ahead, a train was going across the road. All the cars were lit up, you know, like each car, like a 100-car train, and each car had a light on it. And I'm like, what the heck? There's no train tracks up in there. And I drove and drove and kept driving at it. And when I got close to it, the train, like, it drove right up into the mountains, and there's no tracks or anything, and the lights just disappeared. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen.
You know, a lot of very strange things like that happen in the St. Louis Valley. I mean, things like that, things of people seeing airplanes just disappear, people seeing airplanes, helicopters that haven't been around for 30, 40 years flying over their houses. What is going on there? No one knows. I mean, it's right near a rift where the two tectonic plates of the earth are hitting each other. And I know Chris O'Brien, who has done books about that place, thinks that that might have something to do with it. It might release some kind of energy that turns everything around it, paranormal. But I love that story of seeing a ghost train. We've heard of ghost trains before. I'm not surprised to hear that one of them showed up in the St. Louis Valley.
How much of what we see, Mac, might be supernatural, paranormal, as opposed to natural?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of people now who are thinking that UFOs and paranormal things and ghosts and everything are all might be part of the same thing, which is interesting. That maybe there is somehow or other, you know, some other kind of reality intrudes on our reality or our reality intrudes on theirs, and we are seeing things that might be commonplace in another reality, but just not commonplace here. But I did think that's interesting that there might be almost like a unified field theory of paranormal where these things aren't separate at all, that ghosts and Bigfoot and creature sightings and UFOs and ETs and abductions, that they're all part of the same thing. And we just can't put a label on it yet. And, you know, once again, I always say, you know, if scientists look into this, maybe we'd be closer to figuring out exactly what's going on. But something obviously is going on.
It sure is. There's no question. A few more minutes to go. Jonathan in San Francisco. John, go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen. Hi. I was wondering, have you guys seen the video of the International Space Station? They show a UFO in Earth orbit, and if you look it up on YouTube.
Yeah, I've seen that. It's amazing stuff.
I'm sorry?
It's amazing.
I know. I've seen it on a documentary, or it was a documentary and a TV show about 10, 15 years ago that came out on Fox. And, I mean, if you look at the video, the atmosphere actually lights up seconds before this thing just shoots up at the craft, and the craft backs up. I mean, if we're talking about the same video, I mean, it just looks amazing. If you rewatch the video, you'll see that the atmosphere lights up within the Earth's atmosphere, and then you'll see the beam shoot up. I seriously think it was a part of that energy weapon that they have. There's this thing that they have, I think it was on Ancient Aliens, I'm not sure, but the government has this weapon that's able to heat up incoming missiles and blow them up within mere seconds.
It's almost like Tesla technology.
Exactly. I saw it on that same TV show that came out on Fox. It was the episode where they showed that video clip, and then it came out multiple times in documentaries and in TV shows, so I figured it has to be legit. And, I mean, there's so many videos of just looks like stars or potentially comets going, but then they stop and then change direction.
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder, I mean, what's really going on here?
It's great video, Mac. Strange things are up there.
Well, we're definitely doing things with like energy weapons. There's no doubt about it that we have some kind of energy weapon technology going on. We have these secret small little junior-sized space shuttles that the military sends up every once in a while, unmanned. They really won't. They say that they have to do with weather and communications research, which is the cover story. These things we'll find out about, you know, 5-10 years from now. But the interesting thing is that when we find out about them, that just means that the military has moved on to something even more exotic.
No doubt.
That's just the way it goes.
Let's go to Donna in Canada. Hey, Donna, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm probably the last one.
Yes, you are.
Okay, this happened in 1992.
I was really tired, lay down in bed. Suddenly I heard a noise. When I looked up, there was a guy in a yellow raincoat hooking something up to my bedroom curtain, my bedroom curtain.
Yeah.
And he was speaking to somebody in the living room. And then he said, okay, at 7:28 at midnight, transformation will happen. And then I came to. I was kind of in a dozy space. I came to, called my friend. So we figured out that was July 28th, and it would be at midnight. So I lived near the Detroit River, only in Windsor, and my friends and I went down, and we sat there. We went about 10 minutes before midnight, and we lit a little fire, and we just kept looking up and looking up, and the sky was as clear as anything. And all of a sudden, we did a countdown, and at midnight, over to the right, at the end of the river, up in the sky was this plane, and it was going in circles, up and down, up and down. It was like a light going up and down and up and down. And exactly at midnight, it was over top of Detroit, right in front of us, and it went into six different balls, back into one, and disappeared.
Hey, that's remarkable stuff. Now, you're next to Selfridge Air Force Base, which is up there near Mount Clemens, Michigan, which is way up to the northeast. But strange things do happen. Mac, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program, and keep in touch with us, okay?
Will do, Judge. Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Mac Maloney's latest book called Beyond Area 51. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and John B. Wells, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.